This is a BICOM podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM based here in Israel. I'm delighted to be joined today by a former colonel in the IDF, Pnina Shalvit Baruch. Pnina, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
If I can just give a little bit of background, Pnina served, as I said, as a colonel in the IDF in the International Law Department for 20 years, five of which she was the head of the department. Since leaving her service in the IDF, she is now a senior researcher at the INSS and also lectures at Tel Aviv University, where she teaches courses in international law and conflict resolution. She is also a lecturer at the National Security College. Pnina, I would like to kind of to get into the issue which is kind of foremost in our minds about the issues of Israel extending sovereignty or annexation, as it's referred to as well. Perhaps just using your legal background, if we could start from your perspective, what is the current status of the West Bank?
Well, that's the you started with the tough one. It depends who you ask, but I would say that the vast majority of the world and of scholars would define it as the occupied territory, and some would also go ahead and say that it is Palestinian occupied territory. That's at least the way it is called in UN resolutions and human rights. The council resolution
and the British government as well,
and yes, and others too. So and so we have here two elements: the one being occupied, and the other being belonging to the Palestinians, or that the Palestinians have the rights there. If you ask Israel, the answer would be a bit different. And here there are two different approaches. One contends that it is wrong to describe the territories as occupied. In the first place, the idea here is that these territories were never belonged to another state, which is true, because they never belonged to another state. They were part of the Ottoman Empire, but after that, they went to the British Mandate and didn't belong to any country. And when Jordan tried to annex the West Bank after 1948, 1949, its annexation was not accepted by any country, except the only two countries actually that did recognize the annexation were Pakistan and the UK. But even Jordan itself in 1988 gave up its claim to the territories. So it never belonged to another country. And the position says, okay, if it never belonged to another country and the rights there were of the mandate and the we have the Balfour Declaration and other documents talking about a homeland for the Jewish people in this area, then this territory doesn't belong to anyone. We have also, we Israel have good claims, so we don't need to look at it at all as occupied territory. And the problem with this position is that occupation and seeing a territory is occupied relates to a factual context. And the facts are that this territory was taken, or the control over this territory was taken by Israel in the course of an armed conflict, the 1967 war. And the prevailing, legal view is that territory that is occupied during an armed conflict becomes, is termed as a occupied territory. The situation is a situation of a belligerent occupation. And Israel always treated the territory in such a way because it created a military government there. It used the laws of belligerent occupation. And even in Hebrew, we would call it Tfisa Lochamtit, which is belligerent occupation. And it applied the Hague regulations. It referred to the Geneva Convention, although saying it's only de facto applies because of the article that deals with the authority under this convention. But still, it did treat the territory as under belligerent occupation. So it's difficult today to say that it's not occupied. But there's another point, and here I think there's a better case from the Israeli perspective, is that even if we see it as occupied because it was occupied during a war, it doesn't mean that it is Palestinian. It is rather the question of sovereignty is disputed. There was no prior sovereign, and this territory now there's a question of who should have this territory. And here we have claims of the Palestinians based on their right of self-determination, which is a right that was only developed in the second half of the 20th century. But even if we accept it, it doesn't necessarily mean that this right means that they have a right for a state on the whole of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It means that they have a right for self-determination, maybe through a state, maybe on part of the territory. So here, and Israel also has its claims for this territory. So I think there could be a more nuanced approach saying there's a dispute. The sides agreed that this will be determined through negotiations, and the negotiations should determine where the border is within this area, even though we should give part of it at least to the Palestinians, or not give, part of it should belong to the Palestinians, say, to manage to implement their right of self-determination. So this is a more nuanced approach. But again, when you look at the world and the way it is, viewed by almost all international institutions, including the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, in its advisory opinion of 2004 on the fence or the wall in the territories, it is viewed as a Palestinian occupied territory that belongs where the Palestinians have the rights, and therefore Israel has no right to not to settlements and also not to annex any part of it to Israel.
Thank you for that thorough answer. Tell me, as I mentioned in my opening, kind of is there just a semantic difference between the terms of annexation or the extension of sovereignty, the extension of Israeli law, or is there a legal distinction between those terms?
So there's not so much a legal distinction. Applying sovereignty is carried out by applying the law, and applying sovereignty is indeed annexing the territory. There is a difference here in which is linked to my previous answer, is that when you talk about annexation, you usually would refer to annexing something that belongs to another state. And since here, again, the territory doesn't belong to another state, and according to Israeli official position, doesn't belong to the Palestinians either, then we are just applying our sovereignty over this territory, but we are not annexing it. We're not taking it from anyone else. But again, the world uses the term annexation, and annexation doesn't necessarily have to be of a territory of another state. So it could also apply to disputed territory. And applying the law is the means of carrying out annexation or application of sovereignty. It is carried out through applying the law. So talking just about applying the law and saying this doesn't mean annexation is also a bit problematic. Theoretically, Israel could say, I am not contesting that the territory doesn't belong to Israel, but I'm applying my law for technical reasons to make it easier. But that's not the approach. It's not what it's doing. It's the application, or the whole idea of applying the law, is in order to apply sovereignty. So we are talking about the law being applied as a way to apply sovereignty. That even appears in most of the proposed legislation, in the explanations, they are talking about applying sovereignty.
Thank you. In the past, as I mentioned, when you were serving in the International Law Department of the IDF, part of your role was to advise IDF commanders and decision makers in government relating to issues on international law and administrative law. If you're in the position today, what advice would you offer the current leadership?
So I think the idea of applying sovereignty or annexing a part of the territory will be perceived by the international community, or most of the international community, as an unlawful act. It might complicate further our situation also in the International Criminal Court. Although, as it is, it seems that the prosecutor at least has made up her mind, or it seems that she's already taken a position about both the authority to deal with the case and also about the unlawfulness of the Israeli settlements there. So I don't know how much it would change her mind or make it worse, the fact that we also annexed part of it. But still, of course, it won't help us in that arena. It could lead to more pressure also from other countries, for example, in Europe, who will see this as a very problematic step. It's, of course, against their position. Israel could face, worst case would be sanctions. But even before that, you can have all kinds of, pulling out from all kinds of small agreements or from investments or from assistance due to such a step. The U.S. current administration would probably support such a move, but the U.S. future administration, if it's a democratic administration, could also turn against Israel and even maybe support a resolution in the U.N. Against such a move, something that would be vetoed by the Trump administration probably, but not necessarily by a Biden administration. So Israel could face international law repercussions. So that's one thing I would warn about against. And secondly, internally, we have to understand what is the meaning of such a step internally for Israel. So one thing is that once the law is applied, it's very easy to apply the Israeli law. Actually, you don't even need the legislation. You can apply the law in a government decision. That was what was done, for example, in Jerusalem in the beginning. But even if it's the right way is, or the more correct path is to do it through legislation, it's an easy law to pass in the current Knesset. But once you apply the law to any part of the West Bank, taking that step back, I mean, trying to cancel, this will be much more difficult because according to the current Israeli legislation, you would need either 80 members of Knesset or a referendum in order to cancel the application of the Israeli law on any kind of territory. So what this means, and although there are those who say that maybe the law that says this could be changed with 61 members of the Knesset, maybe. But anyway, it would be very difficult internally for politically to cancel such a decision. So in essence, what this is doing, it's a step to tie the hands of any future government who would want maybe to negotiate about the areas that have been annexed. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that once you annex, it depends, of course, then it changes. We don't know exactly what will be annexed, where will the sovereignty lie. But if we are talking about areas that include Palestinian residents, and there are some of the options, this could include such areas, then those Palestinians will become residents of the State of Israel with all the rights that apply to residents of the State of Israel. The right of freedom of movement in Israel, the right of social security, the right to ask for citizenship, and we have to take that into account. And if we want to annex areas that they have where Palestinians reside and try not to give them the full rights of residency or the opportunity also even to become citizens and keep them always in some kind of diminished status, that would be, I think, very problematic for Israel. It would make it difficult for Israel to retain its democratic values because the democracy is not supposed to have two kinds of civilians, A and B. So I think it would put a lot of pressure internally on our values. So I see a lot of problems with the proposed idea. And my main question mark is what are we getting for it? I mean, what are the benefits? And here, it's less and less clear today what exactly are the benefits of such a move.
That we may have to ask other people to defend that. Tell me, do you think there's a distinction between making a declaration on this issue and then actual implementation, or kind of in the declarative stage as you pass kind of passing the legislation, that is kind of de jure and de facto a done deal?
I think de facto, if we're talking about the settlements, de facto the settlements in many aspects already, when you're there, you feel as if you're exactly in Israel. Most of the, while the Israeli legislation doesn't apply as such in the settlements, it does apply, most of it does apply by military orders that actually introduce and adopt the Israeli legislation and so that it applies in the settlements. And also Israeli legislation that is personal in nature and defines the Israeli residents applies to the residents, the Israeli residents of the settlements. So de facto, in many spheres, the Israeli authorities already exercise their authority in the settlements. The legislation is in many cases very similar, except when it comes maybe to land and planning and zoning, infrastructure issues where the law is different. So the main difference would be the de jure one. So, and I think the idea in this step is to make the de jure change. Because de facto, as it is today, the green line is really not felt anymore on the ground. It doesn't appear in the textbooks, you know, when you study at school. So de facto, I think a lot already has been done. This step is meant to do the jure kind of step.
Thank you. I mean, you mentioned the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and the potential investigations underway. What do you make of their case, and how concerned are you about it?
Well, I think it's there is room for concern. The prosecutor has requested the court to give a decision on its jurisdiction, on the jurisdiction in this case, because of the question whether Palestine is a state and whether the territory of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is its territory indeed. So he did ask the court to give its ruling on this before opening an investigation, but the position that it is, but the prosecutor did produce a very detailed position, and clearly she believes that that is the case. And also she emphasizes in this position that she sees the Israeli actions as unlawful. So prosecutor seems already to give a position that Israeli, for example, that Israeli settlement activity is unlawful. And I wouldn't count on the court, on the pretrial chamber, to say that there's no jurisdiction. I believe they will give the possibility, either they will rule that there is jurisdiction or they will postpone the decision and say we'll rule about it in the end. But I don't think they are going to stop an investigation. And the investigation could lead to it could lead to indictments even against political levels, even against prime minister and ministers, because there is no immunity even to those that are still presiding. So we could face a difficult challenge there.
Thank you. We may well come back and visit that in the weeks and months ahead. If I can take you back again to your role when you were serving in the IDF, one of your other positions was as a legal advisor to the negotiations with the Palestinians. What insights can you share from that experience?
Well, I think it's frustrating. I spent many years on the negotiations, or doing negotiations with the Palestinians, and we felt at one stage that we were very close. I think the reason we didn't reach an agreement during the 2000s, or the first was because of the Palestinians. The Palestinians showed no flexibility, even when they were offered, even, for example, Bill Clinton, later on also in Olmert and Annapolis, even when they were offered a very reasonable settlement, peace settlement, they continued to really have very maximalistic approaches, including the right of return, which means having, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians potentially enter into Israel, go back to their houses that are not there. including other issues that in Jerusalem, their position was very firm, also with regard to places that are holy for the Jews. And even they were not ready to acknowledge that Israel is the homeland of the Jewish people. So I think they made it difficult for Israel to make the compromises that were necessary there because they were not ready to compromise. I think, however, that it is unfortunate that the side stopped talking. Because I think the fact that the negotiations didn't go anywhere doesn't mean that we don't need to continue trying to reach a negotiated settlement. And I do know Palestinians. I have had contact with Palestinians also since then, also in a few track twos. And I think there is a possibility to reach a settlement by through negotiations. Of course. We have to be very careful. Of course, the whole issue of security has to be, Israel has to be very firm on its security requirements. This would require the Palestinians to compromise on having full sovereignty in a potential Palestinian country. But I think it's wrong to go already now to unilateral steps without exhausting negotiations. And I think also even tactically it's wrong. Israel should say, let's negotiate. And if again the Palestinians are not ready to make any kind of compromise, if again we get to a deadlock, then maybe it could be justified to take unilateral steps. But then again, these unilateral steps should have the logic of ending the conflict, of putting a border and saying, okay, we'll decide on our own border on ourselves if you don't want to compromise. But not as what is happening now, that it seems that the steps that we are taking or planning to take are not based on a rationale of that would be our final border, but more on rationales of internal political considerations.
And just on those internal political considerations, I suppose a last question. Your assessment, we're talking here at the beginning of June. We know that there is the earliest date that they can bring this to either the Knesset or the government is the 1st of July. But others are speculating that it may get delayed, not less because it needs the consensus of the US, and they clearly have other things on their plate right now. But also the idea of protecting existing peace agreements and regional stability, as it said in the government guidelines. What's your assessment of where this is going in the timeline and how quickly this will come on the agenda?
Well, I think the two question marks are the U.S. Will the U.S., and clearly it is busy with other things, but will that mean that they will put a break on the annexation ideas, or will they give a green light and say, okay, do whatever you want and just keep us out of it? I don't know. But the second one is the Israeli government and mainly Kahol Lavan, Gantz and Ashkenazi. We would expect them to be more responsible. I think they are not. They don't come with the ideological baggage trying to address supporters from the ideological right. The people that voted for them are not necessarily people that would support annexation. Especially again, when it's not clear what are the benefits of this annexation, the people that are concerned with the Israel's security, but annexation doesn't help Israel's security at all. I mean, we can do whatever we want to do, we can do without annexing the territory when it comes to security measures. So really, there's a threat, which I didn't also mention, that this will lead to an outburst, a new violence, a new wave of violence, of terrorism. We need soldiers going in there. The Palestinian Authority might collapse, and we need to take care and deal with all the civilian issues there, which will be also cost us a lot, economically problematic. Soldiers will start again going into the streets of the main cities. Soldiers' lives will be at stake. I think they would not like this kind of outcome, and I would still expect them to put their foot down and oppose any kind of measure that has all these risks with very, very few benefits on the other side. But again, here, the internal politics have become very strange in Israel. It is not clear today how and what they are considering. How are they acting? So I still hope that they will also be something that all will also be those that will stop things from within.
Well, we will continue to watch this space and follow it closely. Thank you so much for your insight and analysis today. That was really, really excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.